Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
In perusing social media, as I've been known to do, I know it's a hellscape, but sometimes you do it, I came across a post from Bill Malugan over at Fox News, who has been covering the border and covering the border well, and he is discussing a report from NBC News. And this report from NBC News states quite clearly that an Afghan on the FBI terror watch list has spent almost a year in the United States, and then when apprehended by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a federal judge ordered him to be released on bond, and this guy, who is on the terrorist watch list, is now out and about across the United States. Tony Katz, Tony Katz Today. Good to be with you. Griff Jenkins of Fox News joins me right now, who's been covering the border since before it was cool. You can catch him weekends on Fox News. This NBC reporting does comport with things that you have been talking about over the last years in terms of, A, not knowing who the gotaways are, the people who evade detection and apprehension of Border Patrol, but we know that there are terrorists or terrorist-aligned groups, cells, however you want to describe it, who have gotten into the country. But this is a step in a new direction with the border where you know somebody's on the watch list and a federal judge allowed them to be released on bond anyway. What is the story?
Yeah, Tony, it's great to be with you. And look, you know, Bill Malugian and I have, we talk all day, every single day. We are constantly trying to do the border story. And it's actually with welcome arms that we see other networks, in this case, NBC, covering it. That's why we've been at the border for the majority of our adult lives the last couple of years, living in Texas and California and Arizona with the drone in the sky showing the crisis that's unfolded under this administration. But specifically to this NBC thing, and I'm about to go through the details with you, we saw it. We immediately, I was leaving the State Department last night where I was reporting about 7 o'clock. Bill hits me up, we forward it to DHS, and DHS actually got Bill and I on a Zoom call at 10 o'clock last night where they wanted to talk a lot about it. There were some holes that we had to sort of fix, but overall, the NBC reporting was accurate. And by the way, this isn't the first time we've had a terrorist released, an individual matched terror watch list released in the U.S., which is startling in and of itself. But specifically with this guy, what's astonishing, Tony, and the only thing you need to, you know, drill in on if you're listening to this now, is that this is a classic case of why this administration's catch and release policies puts national security at risk. Because this individual was on the terror watch list, twice released, and roamed the country for 11 months. Now, DHS has him in custody now. But to go back, he originally crosses the border and is apprehended by Border Patrol in San Ysidro, California, in March of 2023. He's referred to ICE because all apprehensions from Border Patrol happen at the point of contact, and then they're referred to ICE and either detained. There's no detention space, so now you do have these alternatives to detention. Now, in this initial apprehension, at the time of apprehension, there wasn't conclusive information that matched them to the FBI's terrorism watch list. Now, we pressed, and as usual, it's vague, but basically they might have had a reason to think he might match it, but they didn't have the pieces of the puzzle to match him. So this guy, Mohammed Karwin, 48 years old from Afghanistan, now believed to be tied to a Afghanistan terror group that's killed at least 9 Americans in the last several years in terrorism events, spends 11 months roaming the U.S., and in during this time, additional what they call derogatory information was developed, and so then he's officially added to the terror watch list in February, just 2 months ago, by the FBI. At that point, ICE prioritized, went out and arrested him, in this case in San Antonio. At the court hearing a few weeks ago with the federal immigration judge, the judge did release him on bond, despite concerns raised by DHS, because they were asking him, making the case he was a flight risk. But the DHS attorneys did not tell the judge he was a match to the terror list, because it appears they didn't have the clearance to disclose classified information to the judge. And so the judge really isn't at fault here. However, DHS, it should be noted, did not appeal the judge's decision to release him. But then something happened and ICE went quickly out and rearrested him. He's in custody right now. By the way, Tony, his next court date is in 2025. Why he's spending another night in the United States is beyond me, but that's another matter perhaps.
You know, it's funny.
Just to, you know, wrap your head around it. So what I've just told you, they get him initially in March last year. He doesn't have enough information to match him to the terror watch list. They release him with an alternative to detention. I mean, he's got a bracelet, an ankle bracelet. And then they get the additional information 11 months later, bring him in. But then the DHS attorneys can't tell the judge he's a national security risk. And so he releases him. And so if that's not kind of a classic case of how broken this system is, and it comes, by the way, in full context, because of the catch and release policies that migrants know and cartels know they can exploit, you've got unprecedented numbers coming and guys like this coming. It just paints the picture as clear as day, and it is why you've got officials like the Border Patrol chief worried not only about cases like this, but the 140,000 plus gotaways.
This is exactly the point that I was going to make, talking to Griff Jenkins of Fox News. You can catch him on Fox News Live weekends. He's all over the channel every single day. The man who knows the border like no one else, because the brokenness of the policies brings us to Alejandro Mayorkas. Now, you're in D.C. right now. You, of course, work the Hill beat as well. You've got the impeachment, of course, from the House of the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, for not doing his job. They have not sent this over to the Senate. The Senate has so much as said, hey, hold off. You're going to have issues with Chuck Schumer and the Democrats here. What is the latest on the impeachment while we have a few minutes? Is the Senate going to accept this, and is Schumer going to push it to the side?
Listen, I couldn't tell you what's going to happen, but I can tell you what, if you and I were betting $20 and a beer, I would bet that Schumer is going to find a way to sideline this. And, you know, at the end of the day, Mayorkas is the face of this crisis, but it is his boss, Joe Biden, that you know, it's his policies, not Mayorkas's. Mayorkas is following the orders. So I'm not even sure the trial ultimately would end up in the impeachment as the House has found him. However, you know, one thing, just to step back for a second, when Mayorkas was on the Hill just the last 24 hours and finally admitted that it's a, quote, crisis, and used that word, it was really, I took a step back, because I'm like, he finally is willing to call it what it is. And so, you know, whether they were dragged kicking and screaming to admit to what we've got, but we're there now. And it comes at a time, I tie those two events together, because Mayorkas possibly going to face something in the Senate. I'm not sure Republicans are going to have much success, because again, Schumer's driving the boat, the majority leader. You know, he's holding all the cards, because he decides what comes to the floor, and we'll see if there's a movement to dismiss it quickly out of the gate. One thing's for sure, it's not going to not happen. It's just a question of what happens. But even short of him, I think, being impeached in a Senate trial, the American people know. The American people get it. And getting rid of Mayorkas at this point, at this juncture, would do little, to be honest, to solve the problem. And, you know, just widening the scope here and putting all things into context, while you've got Mayorkas facing an impeachment trial in the Senate, you just had up on the Hill yesterday the director of the FBI, Chris Wray, saying that more so than ever, they're worried that individuals or small groups are going to carry out a terrorist attack, particularly motivated by what they see happening in the Middle East. Well, guess what? I'll bet you there's a good possibility that he could have crossed the border, and that's how they got through, if these any individuals did indeed, you know, carry out a terror attack. And in our reporting last night with Bill, we're talking to DHS, they did put out a statement saying, and they sort of said the same thing frequently, which is they say, if an individual poses a national security threat, we deny admission, detain, remove, or refer them to federal agencies for prosecution. But that's just words, because it's not happening. We're seeing time and time again. And, you know, you do the math. Eventually, you know, one of these things is going to happen.
Griff Jenkins, Fox News. You find him weekends, co-anchor of Fox News Live, and, of course, across the news channel. Griff Jenkins, always a pleasure. I've got more coming up. This is Tony Katz Today.
And there's Charles Woodson. How about that? And what a season he had. Great, Andy. He became the first defensive player to win the Heisman Trophy. And congratulations, Charles. That is something that no one can ever take away from you. Unless you kill your wife and a waiter, in which case... all bets are off. Just a word of advice.
No one told the O.J. Simpson joke. No one skewered O.J. Simpson like Norm MacDonald. Absolutely no one, and you got to admit, poor Charles Woodson, he was a kid then, a kid, and just the OJ joke, and it landed, and it delivered, and it was everything Norm did. I mean, he got fired for it, of course, part of the reason he was fired for Saturday Night Live, but worth it. My God, I hope he thought it was worth it. Tony Katz Today, good to be with you. Find everything I'm doing over at TonyKatz.com. Become a supporter. I'd greatly appreciate it. Of course, OJ, it got announced, dead at the age of 76, cancer, surrounded by his family. Okay, great. Surrounded by your family. Good on you. They still loved you. At least someone did. But that's not the story. The story is how people are responding to it. I even mentioned yesterday, like, the jokes are already coming out. Like, the same day, the jokes were there, and people had commentary. It was like, good Lord, that's a lot of pent-up emotion, for sure. Then the headlines came, and now I'm at a loss. And when I say I'm at a loss, I am a level of confused that it's hard to describe. This was the Associated Press. Legendary athlete, actor, and millionaire, O.J. Simpson's murder trial lost him the American dream. I'm sorry. I don't know what to do with that. I can barely comprehend it. Now, there are things I can comprehend, madness that I was expecting. Now, maybe not in toto. For example, Mark Lamont Hill. Everybody knows this was a guy who was with CNN, and of course, his anti-Israel sentiment and Jew hatred is strong. This was him on X. O.J. Simpson was an abusive liar who abandoned his community long before he killed two people in cold blood. Okay. Well, maybe I wouldn't know him about being an abusive liar, but he did kill two people in cold blood, in my opinion. Maybe I would agree with Mark Lamont Hill. Oh, no. Next sentence. His acquittal for murder was the correct and necessary result of a racist criminal legal system. He ends with, but he's still a monster, not a martyr. He's a monster, he's a murderer, and he should have been acquitted because he was black? How do you write this sentence? He can kill two people and that's bad, but he shouldn't go to jail because that would be racist. You can argue that's a full-on broken society, right? That is broken. Enter so-called intellectual Michael Eric Dyson on CNN.
What was the point you wanted to raise, Michael?
Well, I want to first address Jeffrey's point there about the heinousness. It is true that it was tragic, evil, and an unforgivable assault upon two human beings who lost their lives. But to say that was the greatest tragedy in light of the accumulated indignities, murders, denials of opportunity, failure to give just due to African-American people in the court system, that, my friend, is a weighted tragedy that we cannot merely dismiss. So
this is now a talking point. And this goes back to the whole conversation of, you know, when the OJ verdict was read and America was really split and in a lot of ways racially, and I certainly, because you would never say everyone from every group was in a certain direction. But I talked about that Family Guy skit. That family, it was Brian and his roommate at the time. And it was the O.J. Simpson verdict coming out, and it's very, very well done. I mean, super.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty.
Yes. What the hell?
What?
Maybe we should get new roommates.
Yeah, maybe we should.
The roommate's black. There's Brian. They literally pull guns on each other. I mean, it divided people. But it's good that OJ didn't go to jail, that he was found not guilty because racism. You understand how unserious these people are about the American experiment, how unserious they are about the actual rule of law. It's an unseriousness. And just for the sake of clarity, if you think I'm saying black people, I'm clearly not. Because there are plenty of black people who would be like, oh yeah, that man's guilty of sin. The idea of thinking of people in monolithic blocks, monolithic groups, is a danger. It shouldn't happen. But when we talk about, for example, progressive thought, that's where you get to this. You see, it's good he didn't go to jail because, you know, racism. He's a murderer. But go back to this Associated Press headline. Legendary athlete, actor, and millionaire, O.J. Simpson's murder trial lost him the American dream. With Mark Lamont Hill and Michael Eric Dyson, who I find both deplorable people, it doesn't matter that they murdered someone. That is wrong. But as long as they don't go to jail for it, because somehow finding them guilty would be racist. But the Associated Press doesn't even mention that he killed two people. Or at least the accusation that he killed two people. That's incredible. And you wonder, I mean, this took place in 1995, right? I forget when the trial was, but the everything happened in 1995. So it's been 30 years. 30 years it has been. This is where we've come in our journalism? And the answer is no. I let the cat out of the bag. It's not where we've come in journalism. It's where we may have always been culturally. If you saw people saying, good, I'm glad he was found not guilty because a black man should not be found guilty. And they're still saying it. People cheered for it then. They're saying it now. There are allegedly members of the jury who are like, oh, yeah, I was never going to find him guilty. We weren't going to do that to a black man. And they admit it. And it's super weird stuff. It's dangerous, ugly stuff. A jury of your peers means that you're looking at the evidence presented, not at the color of the skin of the defendant or of those making the accusations. This response is nutty and really ugly for society. But if you can't start with OJ was a murderer, if you can't start with OJ, who was accused of murdering his wife and a waiter, you're not telling the story. Legendary athlete, actor, and millionaire. Well, sure, but that's really not the story now, is it? And then you say the murder trial cost him or lost him the American dream. He's the one I should feel for? Not Ron Goldman, not Nicole Brown Simpson? Dear Lord, man. The Associated Press is something else. Something else. Find everything I do at TonyKatz.com. I've got more to get to, guys. This is Tony Katz Today. never mind the right versus left of it, right? The issues with progressivism, the values of conservatism as I see it. There have to be places where we admit clearly amongst all people some ideas are absolutely terrible ideas. The whole reason for free speech is to be able to take an idea, put it into the public sphere, and say, yeah, that idea sucks. Quite to no other point, there is that. Tony Katz today. What is going on, everybody? Find everything I do at TonyKatz.com. There was a piece that has made big news. It came from FP, which is the free press, TheFP.com. And it is, I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. And it's from Uri Berliner. I believe I'm pronouncing his name right. And it's a story about how NPR was not interested in news. It was interested in narrative. Something we've discussed many times, but now we're seeing the admission, right? You can go back to Barry Weiss resigning from the New York Times and how it was these elitists at the Times thought they knew how to lecture to us and they could only tell us the truth. Now we see it from NPR, things we already knew. The question before us is how can anybody think that them having done this is good? And even though these truth, these realities come out, what makes us think they're going to change? Ed Morrissey joins me right now. He is the managing editor of HotAir.com. He also does the Ed Morrissey show. His book, Going Red, focusing on swing voters and the need to expand the Republican and conservative brand through peer-to-peer engagement, is available at Amazon.com, wherever fine books are sold. You dug a little bit deeper into this. The piece, All Things Considered, I like the pun there. All Things Considered, it's long past time to defund NPR. When you read the story over there at TheFP.com, at the Free Press, was any part of you surprised?
None at all. The only thing I found surprising is that somebody was willing to talk about it who'd been on the inside of it. And I think that speaks to how bad it's gotten. But NPR has been like this for a long time. And I mean, I actually took, you know, two whacks at this. The first one was to very roughly rebut Berliner's claim that this started in 2016, that they were responsible and credible and reliable up until Donald Trump, which is nonsense. We've got plenty of evidence going back decades, really, with NPR, but certainly over during the blogging period, we've had all sorts of different issues with NPR. They fired Juan Williams for saying that people in Muslim garb made him nervous. And it wasn't even on NPR's air. This was on a different show. While Juan Williams was talking about the fact that their civil rights should be preserved, we shouldn't be, you know, what's the word that the TSA uses? You know,
profiling?
Profiling, yes. Shouldn't be profiling them. But he was saying, look, I mean, there's my human reaction is this, but we should really resist that. And they fired him for it. And this is 2010. And 2010. That was in 2010. There's been all sorts of incidents like this where they've cooked stories, where they have really been what we're kind of calling now regime media, but basically apologists for the progressive left. And Berliner's probably too close to it to realize that, but NPR's credibility issues go well before 2016. They just got a lot more obvious when Donald Trump came down the escalator.
Juan Williams is a good poll, right? It's a good callback situation. But if we remember correctly, they didn't just fire him. They said that there was something wrong with him mentally. They questioned his mental state. Which is, you know, that's the burning of the bridge. You're never welcome back. We are going to so rip apart your credibility for engaging, for him, honestly, in a conversation. The NPR dishonesty, the mainstream media dishonesty that we often discuss was maybe more personified more recently in the New York Post story regarding the Hunter Biden laptop. If NPR is not interested in apologizing for not covering for that story, your point is why would they get our public funding? Now, this is different than maybe how we treat the New York Times and whatever. Talk to me about the mechanism by which we fund NPR, National Public Radio, and what the suggestion is.
Well, first off, federal funding flows to NPR, and also state and local funding, government funding, goes to NPR through a couple of ways. One is direct, which is actually rather small. And NPR has said, you know, less than 1% of our revenue comes from direct federal government subsidies. But they'll also admit that, well, when you talk about indirect, right, where stuff that's coming to the Center for Public Broadcasting, which then pays for NPR programming, and through grants and, you know, federal grants and other things, and subsidies for public radio stations, you know, regional public radio stations that also feed stories back into NPR, they're saying it's, well, it's more around 10%. All right. If it's that negligible, then do away with it. I mean, there is no reason. I mean, just simply, there's no reason for the federal government to have its own media outlet. There's no reason for it, especially aimed at a domestic audience. Yeah, and we can talk about Voice of America, which is a foreign policy tool and has been used in the past to try to get truthful stories into places where the media is tightly controlled. There's value in that, but we have plenty of media outlets here in the United States. It's basically carrying the same water as NPR does, and they have to compete against NPR because NPR is subsidized. They also have nonprofit status, which is something that saves them a lot of money. They don't have to pay taxes on the revenue that they get. So there's all sorts of different ways that NPR benefits from government funds in the United States, and none of it's legitimate. There's no legitimate reason for us to be having any sort of public financing of media in the United States.
Talking to Ed Morrissey, managing editor of hotair.com, I want to go back to how I started, which is to take us out of the political of this, which it's not that I disagree with you about the funding of NPR. Let them find private funding and go about doing what it is that they do,
sure.
not public funding, right? This isn't about saying you can't be on the air. This is about saying we shouldn't be the ones paying for it. But this is a much greater conversation about the value of the take. So I do conservative talk, and I talk culture, and I talk politics, and I talk bourbon, all sorts of things. But I could decide I'm not talking about a certain thing today. That's different than preventing a certain thing from being said today. And what NPR's and the New York Times and others did with, for example, the Hunter Biden laptop story is not only say we refuse to discuss this, they worked to discredit it and then tried to get others to not cover it as well. And the question before us is, outside of a political advantage, what societal advantage does this offer? And I guess to put in a follow-up, which I hate to do, you should do one question at a time. Don't they realize that this is no way to have a society?
Yeah, I mean, first off, I don't know what the societal benefit is to NPR, but it's very much, NPR has a very inflated value for it. And Uri Berliner, who wrote the piece, has a far too inflated sense of value for it, too. NPR doesn't do anything that CBS or the New York Times or, Westwood One, I guess, if you want to talk about radio platforms, does. It's just that it's allowed to compete on an unfair basis against all of those places doing the exact same thing, right? Because we have a multitude of media outlets in the United States, and all of them now are national thanks to the internet. I mean, the New York Times is a national newspaper, so is the Los Angeles Times, and for that matter, so is the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Oklahoma Star. There's all sorts of different platforms that were regional and local prior to the internet, but now can be accessed by everybody. There's no need for an NPR. There's nothing unique. There's no special quality for NPR that that requires government funding for it or that deserves it. They shouldn't be competing against other for-profit media outlets on an unfair basis through taxpayer funding, especially when their product is so heavily leveraged to propaganda, and you know, I covered some of that in both of those pieces, that it amounts to basically federal propaganda, and regime propaganda that is aimed at an internal audience. I mean, and you know, to use Berliner's examples, there was NPR's refusal to cover the Hunter Biden story, the Hunter Biden laptop story, excuse me. There was their refusal to cover the fact that the Russia gate turned out to be nothing. It was their absolute support for the ever-changing COVID policies of both administrations, right? Trump and Biden. The refusal to even air any sort of effective rebuttals on some of these things, including vaccine effectiveness and including mandates, the effectiveness of mask mandates and shutdowns. They were all in on the elite regime line. There's no reason for the federal government to be funding that other than the fact that it benefits the federal government. It certainly doesn't benefit the taxpayers, and it doesn't benefit the truth.
Talking to Ed Morrissey of hotair.com. So now we get to what is the more philosophical argument here, which is the people who work at the NPRs, the people who work at the New York Times and these other places, they make the claim that they are journalists and that journalistic integrity matters. This is going to become a big conversation with that movie Civil War that's coming out, which supposedly doesn't take a side, you know, in terms of left or right, but certainly does seem to really value the idea of journalists. But how does one value the idea of journalists when they're ideological and not, well, based within what it is we want, which is the story? They're out there. They're working in these places. They see the bias. They know the bias. And they're told that the bias is wrong. How do they square the circle that we should, regardless of whether or not NPR should exist at this stage of the game, how do they square the circle that we should trust them? Or that they provide a value for society?
Again, I think that they feel that they should be trusted based on the fact that all the right people trust them. Right. The same people that they're servicing. And this is part of Berliner's point, too, is that their circle of consumers has narrowed so badly that they've completely lost sight of what everybody else thinks. They've just lost sight of it. There's nobody on the inside that is, tied to even moderate political circles, let alone conservative political circles. They're all urban elitists, out of academia, who are all basically drinking the same wine and without any ability to comprehend that there's a vast, vast population of the country that simply rejects their entire point of view. And they have no idea how to deal with that. And that's part of the reason why. And that's not just at NPR either, Tony. I mean, that's really at most of the media outlets. Again, the problem is that taxpayer funding is what keeps NPR afloat, and that's what needs to stop. I'm like you. I'm not saying, hey, NPR needs to go away. We need to shut down NPR. Absolutely not. But we do need to end all the government funding for it and let it sink or swim on its own. And that's the only way that you reset the incentives here. If we're talking about philosophy, my philosophy is that people respond to incentives, and so when you have to make sure that your incentives are properly set. Right now, having government funding from the same agencies that share that same extremely narrow academia worldview is setting incentives for them to remain as insular as they are today and maybe even more insular in the future. You need to kick that strut out from underneath NPR to get it to wake up.
Ed Morrissey, hotair.com. The book Going Red, get that at Amazon.com, wherever fine books are sold. You can find him on X at Ed Morrissey. That's two R's and two S's. Ed Morrissey, always a pleasure, man. More is coming up. This is Tony Katz Today. So the House makes another run on FISA. We're talking about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. We're talking about Section 702. Tony Katz. Tony Katz Today. Good to be with you. This is what allows the government to collect electronic communication of non-Americans located outside the country without a warrant. But sometimes Americans are caught up in it. And of course, this court has been used and abused for political purposes, whether it be Trump or other conversations. And so there's this idea that we don't need this. We shouldn't want this. This is not who we are. This is beneath us. And then there are those who are saying that this is a tool that helps us in the war against terrorism. Congressman Dan Crenshaw is apoplectic that the House isn't moving faster to do this because he believes that the changes in the legislation fix the issues. And then there's this from the Speaker, Mike Johnson, which has a lot of people up in arms that, you know, I felt one way when I was just a member of Congress, but then I got the classified briefings, and now...
When I was a member of the judiciary, I saw all the abuses of the FBI, the terrible abuses over and over and over, the hundreds of thousands of abuses. And then when I became Speaker, I went to the SCIF and got the confidential briefing from sort of the other perspective on that to understand the necessity of the Section 702 of FISA and how important it is for national security. And it gave me a different perspective. So I encourage all the members to go to the classified briefing and hear all that and see it so they can evaluate the situation for themselves. And I think some opinions have changed both ways, but that's part of the process. You got to be fully informed.
Okay, you got to be fully informed. Here's what we see. We see the abuse of the system, and the abuse of the system, which is not de facto, it is connected to the abuse of the American citizen. And the abuse of the American citizen cannot simply be excused as, yeah, but national security. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. That is not connecting with people. And I think Speaker Johnson made a serious error here. He said, if you knew what I knew, that's not selling something. Because we're not going to know what he knows, because we don't get the classified briefings. Now, at this moment, you get people saying, well, maybe we damn well should get the classified briefings. You want to have faith in the elected officials that we elect them to go do the job so we can go on with our lives, right? They do that job, we do this job, which is, you know, living as American citizens, and that's it. But this is about whether or not we're being surveilled and whether or not the system is being abused. And we've already seen that the system is being abused. So don't ask us just to trust it, you know, for our safety. Meanwhile, it got past the House. The reauthorization gets one hurdle down. We'll see how it goes. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. Monday, everyone. Take care.